Welcome. Class 11 of this two-session sequence. I assume you kind of have a sense of how the first course fits in with the second. Well, I keep reminding you, so I hope it's clear. So I've been thinking about what we've been doing the last few weeks, and I began to think that maybe it's a good idea to center ourselves in the heart of what we're doing. And what I mean by that is, I've been laying out various ideas about thoughts and inhabiting space. And, we've had quite a few new ideas here. They are all meant to turn us toward full presence. That's one way I've started thinking and talking about it. But let's just say toward inhabiting space or activating a different vision of space. Those are all ways we've talked about it. And that really starts on the level of experience, although we'll come back to the word experience later, as I pointed out in the transition, quoting from that passage from Knowledge of Time and Space, Rinpoche uses the word experience, at least when he's focusing in on it very precisely, he uses it in a kind of an unusual way, and we'll come back to that. But for now, I'm just using it in an ordinary way. The quality of being immediately present, let's say. And so I thought, as a kind of a reminder, it would be good to start with a practice that's simply that practice. And that will help set us up. It'll help set up the discussion. But as I say, I hope it's also just a reminder that that's what this is about. It's not about having some cool new theory about the way space and mind and so on interact with each other. So the practice, let's do it for a few minutes, is simply to inhabit the whole, let's say, inhabit the whole of the field, which starts from the body. It really starts with your presence. And the idea is to kind of stay with that center and expand it out so that there is nothing in your experience, in the whole multidimensional range of experience, there's nothing in your experience that is left out. So inhabiting the whole. Let's do that for a few minutes, okay? Okay. So I certainly invite comments. I heard Hayward typing until here's okay, Michael has something. A delicate balance between feeling crowded by things, people, problems, responsibilities, and welcoming the richness of opportunities, allies, and engagement. The whole as a tumbling wall or an open doorway. Now that's nice. I assume the wall is tumbling because you're realizing those are not barriers. You can they can come tumbling down, right? If you blow the right trumpet. Okay. Eliana says, with the space at the center of experience, I can feel myself connected and I feel intimacy. The way awareness is working is very important, a panoramic awareness. Yeah. And I think that's exactly, what we want to remind ourselves of, that we're talking about a way of being in space, of inhabiting space that, is a very sharp break, you could say. I mean, in one way, it's not a break, but it seems very different. It feels very different from our usual experience. And it has to do with intimacy, and it has to do with panoramic awareness. It has to do with feeling connected. And one of the things that we're going to talk about today is at least I think we'll get there, is how awareness is connected with space and with inhabiting space. And this theme of multidimensionality, which I mentioned and which I think was implicit in what Michael said, all of these different things come up. Those are the different dimensions of our presence, our being in space. It's not just physical. We'll talk about that more in a moment. All those different dimensions include, you could say, the dimension of awareness. Or maybe that's a kind of fundamental to all dimensions, however you want to think about it. But we're not always in touch with it, and that's part of what we want to look at. Okay, Klaus said, inhabiting the whole shows that thoughts are tiny little parts of the whole, but most of the time they seem to be all that is there. Yeah, this is, I think this is a very good thing to look at. I think that one of the things I was actually thinking of asking this question as we were doing this practice here, how much of the time were you in a kind of thought realm, and how much of the time were you present to experience? Now, I don't know. I'm not sure those were really completely separate from each other. We may talk about that. But on a certain level, it really makes sense. Like here I am, I'm in my body. That's why, more and more, I mean, for years I've been wondering exactly about the relationship between embodiment and space and exploring it. And the way I think about it right now is that you really do want to ground yourself in the body, and that will make it much easier to engage space. Okay. But a lot of the time, that's not what's going on. A lot of the time, we're in thoughts. And that's kind of what we want to talk about today. Okay. And iPad says, I think that's an alias for Ken, I show up to quickly disappear. Yesterday's news, alert to having just been. That's nice. Yeah, one of the characteristics, of course, I think we've talked about this occasionally, is stories are in the past tense. Stories are the way we make sense of what's already happened, even though it just happened. I think that's what you're saying. Well, a lot of people engaging this. Nice. Okay. Okay, Michael's asking about who is iPad, right? I already gave the game away. It's a alias for Ken, but now he's turned himself into Ken again. I think. Okay. Karen, richness of being here, kind of remembering me, remembering me. That's good. You know, that's so on the one hand, we say, well, the self is kind of an obstacle. The story of the self is an obstacle. But on the other hand, we embodying the whole is also embodying our sense of self, of being here. And, if you're interested in the kind of ongoing discussion these days in the Buddhist world, in the semi-Buddhist world, about mindfulness, part of that discussion centers around the question of what mindfulness actually is, and the term in Sanskrit or in Tibetan means remembering. The most basic meaning is remembering. And so being mindful of, and especially what we're talking about, being mindful of the whole is a way of remembering what's going on. And what's going on is the presence of the whole. So there's an exercise in the first TSK book called Intimacy, which is pretty similar to what we were just doing, that invites you to kind of engage the world and say that too, whatever you encounter, thoughts or objects or whatever, say that too is I. And then in the comment to that, Rinpoche says, well, that may sound like it's just one big ego trip, right? It's just taking advantage of everything, or not taking ownership of everything. He says, no, that's not what we're talking about. So I refer you to that discussion if you want to hear more about that. So that's very valuable to have that sense, you know. Being here fully, that's another, there's so many ways to talk about. Ron asks, what about readouts, the presenting of body, mind, thoughts, etc.? Well, yes. So one of the reasons I said earlier that maybe the distinction between being lost in these tiny little thoughts on the one hand and being present to our experience on the other hand, I said maybe that distinction is not quite so sharp. And I think it's because whatever our experience of the present moment is, you could understand that as being a readout, what are some other ways to talk about that? Being a story, being a space. You know, we've talked about shifting spaces. So here we are, here I am in this room, and, you know, engaging in this experience, and there's a sense in which that has a thought, well, it's not just a sense, that has a thought dimension. I mean, there's a story that's going on about that. It's a readout. So yes, the body, the mind, the thoughts, those are all part of a specific readout. And yet there's a difference between being lost in a thought and then being present to the readout. And that's, again, one of the things I'm hoping we will talk about a little bit today. This part of the class is going on longer than I had expected, but that's okay, because I think what people are reporting or discussing or bringing up here is really central. These are the kinds of things exactly that we want to continue exploring. You know, I mean, this class comes to an end, but exploration and space and time do not come to an end. To encourage this kind of exploration is really important. David says, the steady stream of thoughts subside. Okay, so this is these little thoughts that Klaus is talking about, right? It seems like there's this, and we're going to talk about this today for sure. It seems like there's a kind of an ongoing stream. We just go from one thought to another, to another, to another, to another. And so here we go back into contrasting that to the immediacy of experience, even if on the other side The other way of looking at it is that that too has a thought dimension. It's that too is a readout. But there is a difference. So the steady stream of thoughts subside. The somesthetic sense, I guess it's the body sense, is fully present. And a more global sense is acceded, maybe accessed. Knowing presence seems to be the center of experience. Yeah, that's a good way of describing what we're really trying to engage. As self-concerns, even thoughts and stories, take a sidebar sphere. Right, it's like, thoughts don't have to stop, but they don't take over. They're a sidebar, right? There's a fullness to awareness. So that's nicely described, as always, David. Okay, and Klaus says, the whole is more than all the parts of the whole. Yeah, more than the sum of its parts. So that kind of inhabiting, that full inhabiting, is definitely more than the sum of its parts. Okay, I am going to move on, but that's great. It was only shortly before class that I thought it would be good to do a practice like this to remind ourselves of what's going on, and I'm very glad that we did that. So let me do a very quick review, or at least highlight a key point that I think needs highlighting. And then we'll move on. So the way we've been exploring space and the way the TSK, I would say, presents space. Ooh, I've got one more comment. Let me go ahead and look at it. The readout is dual subject-object. It's as if enedged. While in inhabiting the whole, that separation falls away. Knowing it all is conjured by the foundational space. That's a nice word, conjured. Rinpoche, I don't recall that he's ever used that word, but he likes to talk about the magic of appearance, the magical display, and the conjuring is a part of that. So that would be one way to make sense of this, is to say that when we focus on the readout dimension, we're talking about how something gets set up by someone, and in inhabiting, that's different. Yes. Okay, so in the TSK vision, the kind of space that we're exploring is, of course, not space as we usually understand it. So the way that we usually understand space, I mean, just the kind of man on the street way of understanding space, is physical space, right? Objects show up in space. It's not just the man on the street version, I guess. It's the science version, for the most part. It's the philosophy version. It's what everybody thinks space is. Little do they know. The TSK presents something, a way of thinking about that in which you'd say that's a local representative. I'm borrowing that phrase from the very beginning of TSK, where it's used a little bit differently, but similarly. So physical space is one kind of space, and objects in physical space that goes along with physical space. That's one side of it. The other side of it, and we've been talking about this since the beginning of the first course, but I think maybe now we can clarify it a little bit. The other side of it is that what goes along with physical space is the space of the bystander. You could think of it as a separate space if you want to think dualistically. I don't know if you have to think about it that way, but it's the space where the bystander, the bystander doesn't occupy physical space, right? But that is to say, if I look for the I, if I look for the self, I'm not going to find it as an object in space. Even, if I operate, if I buried deep in my body, if I opened myself up and looked, I'm not going to find the self, the bystander, in physical space. But we do have this very strong sense that the self exists, let's say, or is present. And that way of being present is a kind of a corollary. It goes along with, it's the other side of physical space. So if you have physical space, then you also have a self. You can ignore the self if what you're interested in is physical space, and so that's what science does, for instance. But the two are you know, they're the two sides of a coin. And what's interesting about that, because we've been talking about inhabiting space, is that you can't inhabit physical space. Not in the terms of physical space. You know, objects don't, we talked about this, objects don't inhabit space. They occupy space. And the self, insofar as it's a bystander, doesn't really inhabit space either. It's always trying to inhabit space. It's always trying to be present. But it's in this funny cut-off mode, you know? It's in its own little realm, this bystander realm, completely, you know, I mean, trying to figure out, it's this big problem to be a self, because you're always trying to figure out how you can connect, how you can belong. In some ways, that's the biggest problem, you could say. So inhabiting spaces is completely the other side of that. It's saying, let's drop this picture of physical space on the one hand and thought space, I'm tempted to call it, or bystander space on the other hand. We don't need that model. That's a readout. It's not very fruitful. And we're trying to explore, we are exploring this other way of doing it in which we inhabit the whole. Now, last week we started talking about thoughts and how they're different, or we didn't quite say it this way, but how thoughts are really an obstacle to inhabiting space. And the reason for that we talked about is that thoughts kind of generate their own pseudo space. You know, thoughts have their content, and the content shows up in the thought, but none of it's real. You know? It's just a thought out version. We think about something, we think of something. And that's very different from engaging the thing directly. So again, this goes to the question of what's different about being, about relying on our senses, let's say, about sense experience, which includes embodiment, which is David's description, for instance, but several of you commented on this, this sense of real presence. You don't get that with thoughts. You can never really be present inside a thought, because it has this structure of creating a content which is not real in the same sense as sense experience is real. So the question that I want to mostly focus on this week is, there's several ways of saying it. Let's start off with this way, and this is something that Klaus pointed to. I'm sorry, I just saw another comment by Sudi, and maybe I'll refer to it because it's relevant. The bystander is localized. In inhabiting space, awareness is not localized. Right, so we talk about inhabiting the whole, right? And the bystander is very much localized. And actually, thanks for using the word localized, because it helps me, I think, make the connection between bystander space and physical space or object-centered space. Both of them are localized. That's the point, right? And that's why in the first course, we talked about dislocating experience. And moving instead toward the sense of inhabiting the whole or inhabiting the field is the way that we would talk about it in this course now. Okay, so thoughts are always arising. I was starting to go to Klaus's comment to that effect. And so one question is why? Why are we always thinking? What's going on here? And I've already said something about that when I said that, the self is always trying to make a home for itself in the world. It's always trying to be present because, in fact, by its very definition, it's not. By definition, the self, one way to say this is the self is just a story. Very important, very fundamental. It's the founding story, right? The here I am. But it's not present. And that's a kind of an intolerable situation, it seems. It means that, nothing ever, oh, I don't know how to describe that. Nothing ever goes the way we want. Nothing ever goes. Nothing is ever really set in motion, It's all this sort of fantasy realm that we live in. It's a little bit like if you imagine being a character in a play, or maybe an avatar in virtual reality, let's say. And you kind of become aware of your situation and you realize you're not real. I mean, that I'm drawing on some science fiction stories I read when I was little, but I hope that's clear. It's like you suddenly wake up to the fact that you're just a character in a novel or a character in a play. Somebody's written all your lines, and it is inherently dissatisfying. That's a very mild way to put it. Like, you would like to exist. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So the self is always trying to do that. And the only, you could say the vehicle it has is thinking and stories, right? That's what the self is good at. That's what it does. It tells stories. It thinks thoughts. And there's actually a very interesting shift or movement, between the thought and the story. I think we talked about this a little last week. I'm not sure now. You start off with a thought, and a thought is just, that's sort of like the lines in that the character speaks in the play. There's no reality to it. Reality is not the best word, but let's go with it. Okay. Boy, people keep commenting here. I'm going to catch up again a little bit. Michael says, perhaps a self in its field of relationships is like a spider in its web. If the web vanished, the spider would have no realm of being. Interesting. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting because what comes to mind immediately is sometimes that happens, right? There's a spot, you see a spider web and it's in a place you don't want it to be. So you tear down the spider web and then where's this poor spider? It's still around, but it has no realm of being, right? It's got a, space can be seen as more essential than the pair's spider slash web or self slash field. Yeah. I think that's a good way of thinking about it. It's a separate or different image from a readout, but it's kind of similar, it seems to me, to a readout, right? The self creates, weaves this web, and then, that's supposed to do the job. That's supposed to make it feel real. Ken says the self is a flickering. Well, that's interesting. We'd have to talk more about that, but I don't think I want to do that right now. But certainly what I get out of that is that it's not substantial. It's and flickering makes me think of a, a candle that's about to go out. The self is always on the edge of going out. And so it's desperately struggling to stay lit. So it tells another story. It has another thought. And it's just got to do that. It's like constantly, it's got to do this dance. Okay. Ron says, thinking as friction fiction. That's nice. Isn't the issue also how thoughts are linked to ownership? Only the self is the one who can know. Well, yes, it is. There is a friction, and there is a fiction. I'll go along with that. That's good. I like it. The thing about thoughts is they're always told, you know, they're always, I guess, told, manufactured by a self. And there is always this dimension of ownership. We'll come to that. We'll see how far we can go with this today, because I do want to make one fundamental point, and then we'll see how much farther we go. But David says, we're always thinking to maintain self-existence. Right. So I probably didn't emphasize that right. We're always thinking to maintain self-existence. Right? That's how we do it. Yeah. For everything we see, every idea we bring forth, every object we conjure, there's that word again, we see ourselves reflected in it, like seeing our own image in a pool, which is that image of the image in a pool is in Love of Knowledge, some of you may remember. All objects refer back to me because they came from me, and it is the circle of subject relating to object that I construct meaning out of, the stories I summon, reprise, and recite. I reel off, let slip, call upon, and fill in with stories continuously. Right. Yeah, well, that's nicely, that is exactly right. That is, you know, there are many ways of describing what the self does, and Rinpoche has done that in various places in the TSK books. But that is kind of the central point we're looking at here, is the self is always engaged in a doing which is meant to establish, you know, it's meant to take a position. The self has to do that. Now, if you didn't have to do that, then maybe, to anticipate what Karin asked, maybe then you'd be in a position where you weren't thinking. Right? Because the thinking is exactly, it's, you know, weaving the web is a good image there. It's, you're always busy, you know. So how are webs woven? I don't know much about that, but the substance certainly kind of gets squirted out by the spider, right? And so it's like that. The self is always squirting out these thoughts and stories, in order to have a world, in order to have a reality, in order to be. And then Ron says, caution, I think he's referring to Karin's comment, the self can tell a no-thinking story too. That's true. Yes, I will just go along with that caution. It's probably, there is some possibility of misunderstanding or yeah, if the focus is to say, well, I want to stop thinking. Because then it's possible to enter a no-thinking realm. And I'm sure, Karin, Rinpoche points that out in different ways, so I'm sure it's come up. Klaus says, the self can only know parts of the whole, but the whole cannot be known by a self, only by awareness. Yeah, I think this is very close to where I'd like us to get by the end of the class. It's, you know, the alternative to the self telling its stories and having its thoughts, is to, you might say, decenter the self, so that it's not the self that's doing the knowing. So that line that I think encapsulates, summarizes so much of what TSK is about, knowledge is not what the knower knows. So we need a different way of knowing. Okay. Okay. Michael comments on David's post and says, we're all artists whether we enjoy it or not. I'm not going to try to comment on that because I'd have to figure out what it's referring back up to. Ken says, maybe we subscribe to ourselves. I like that. In other words, I would have said in the past a magazine, but it's more like a daily email that's sent out by the self, right, saying this is the way it is. I like that. Ron says dramaturgical artists. So, yeah, we're all producing plays. I guess dramaturgy is basically that. And David likes that. Okay. So I want to bring in the idea of emotions and emotionality. If you say, what's the transition from a thought to a story? And this is actually a very, I guess I'll say, complicated question. I mean, there's, you know, I'm not sure that what I'm going to say is such an accurate description, but I would say there is a transition. And the transition is that by the time you've gotten around to the story, you are inhabiting a world, or a space, you know. That doesn't necessarily mean you're inhabiting the whole. In fact, that's very, you know, that's where awareness comes into play. But you are inhabiting a world. And so the story that always underlies that and helps show the whole story structure is the founding story, the story of the self that says, here I am, you know, the self in its world. So that's where the self is trying to get. It hopes, it wishes that if it can just get the story straight, you know, or confirm the story, that everything will be all right. Now, it doesn't really work, but it's better than just being a thought, you know. At least that's what the self is trying to do. So how does it get from a thought to a story? What gives thought substance, if substance is the right word? And what I would say is, it's emotions, right? Thoughts are inherently emotional because, and not all thoughts, obviously. I think obviously. But thoughts are emotional because they're trying to bridge the gap between this telling capacity that the self has and reality in the way we normally think of it. So emotions are like the motivation. You know, we have a thought and then it turns into a story. And that movement, that turning into, that's the emotional response or the emotional charge that we put on the thought. So we respond to the world in emotional ways. And of course, the word emotion literally means a kind of moving out, right? The emotion. And I looked it up again the other day, and the early meaning of emotion pretty much meant agitation, which it still also means, but that was the central sense. It could also refer to, you know, like in society there could be unrest. That was also originally emotion. Now we've narrowed it down, but it is this sort of agitated quality that comes up. But the agitation is meant to create something. It's meant to create something real, you could say. But the very nature of an emotion is that it's a movement. It's a movement out, but it's a distorted movement. It turns things in the direction of the self. It's based on an emotion is based on the story of the self. So Rumsfeld, I just happened to come across this quote. He says, thoughts bear an emotional dimension. So that's certainly a good starting point. Thoughts bear an emotional dimension. But we're trying to specify it a little more right now in the few minutes that we have. Everett says, okay, we have several comments. Klaus says, some thoughts have more gravity that pulls more thoughts of the same kind. A story forms. Where's that gravity coming from? Well, that's another way of asking the same question, I think, why do we keep having thoughts? And you're right. You know, some thoughts, you know, there's basically two kinds of thoughts, I'm sure to simplify. There's the thoughts that just pass by and sometimes we don't even notice them. You know, it's like, I think Rinpoche uses the image of cars on the freeway. You know, you're watching cars go by on the freeway, just thought. Or clouds in the sky is the more traditional the more traditional image of how thoughts go by. So that's one kind of thought. But then there's another kind of thought, which, as you say, Klaus, has gravity. And the gravity here, we talked about this last week, I think, and Rinpoche describes, uses that image of gravity quite a bit. It's this force that kind of holds everything in place, you know, which is, you know, an okay definition of gravity in the usual sense. It's a, you know, thoughts create worlds, and they do that by becoming stories. And then we live in those stories. We inhabit those stories. And so that goes back to the readout, another way of talking about it, the readout principle. What we get is a readout or a story of the whole. You could also think of it as a thought of the whole, you know, that tells you the way things are. And there's this gravity in place that does that. And so then the question is, where does that gravity come from? That's the question Klaus is asking here. And I think you could say, and I don't think it's a complete answer, but you could say it's emotional. It's the emotional response that provides the gravity, the energy, let's say, the dynamic. And then that gets translated maybe into the gravity. I'm not sure about that. I'm making that up. And Hayward says, and okay, you're coming at it from a different point here, Hayward, and you're coming at it from a lot of experience in psychotherapy. So I definitely want to honor that. And I think it's more, in some ways, it's a corrective to what I'm saying here. You say emotions are the feelings we live. It's an embodied way of knowing. I think what I would add to that, so let me first say that seems right, you know, that emotions are more real than thoughts. They may be a dimension of thoughts, as Rinpoche suggests in that quote I just read, but they give a certain gravity to the thought. And that shows up in embodied form, and that's what I reacted to first when I said it's a good corrective to what I was saying, because, you know, you can't leave out the embodied dimension of emotionality, it seems to me. But emotions kind of pervade the field. So it's like a mood. We talked about moods a while ago, several classes ago. I think there's a difference between emotions and moods, but I'm not going to try to distinguish it right now. So emotions are, you know, I think it's consistent with what I was trying to say. Emotions are the way that the self turns thinking into reality. And one way that shows up is through embodiment. So there's an interesting, description, you know, in the transition, I quoted from that early chapter in Knowledge of Time and Space, and he's talking about emotions there. He's talking about experience, and he's talking about emotions. And he gives an example of how we start off with the emotion. I'd have to look at it. I'm angry. And then he says, if you can, that can become so intense that it turns into I hate, you know, and then it pervades the field. Maybe the I'm angry is not as pervasive. I'm not sure we can say it quite that way. But emotions certainly have this possibility of tremendous intensity that takes over. But there's also the emotions that are just, they kind of color our situation. Okay, Michael says, like the emperor who's discovered to have no clothes, can a thought be revealed to have only imagined stories? What would it feel like to have naked thoughts arising in emptiness? Right, so one way it might feel is that the thoughts would not be... you wouldn't inhabit them, you know. They wouldn't turn into stories, as you're saying here. So the thought becomes a story, but that's a move that gets made. And if you didn't make that move, then it might be more like thoughts just passing by, you know, like the clouds or the cars. And David says, yeah, and body, that's that somesthetic sense, the base camp. That's a kind of a nice image, the base camp at the foot of a mountain. I have to think about that. Yeah, okay. And Lee gives an analogy that he says, I once heard, moods are like seasons and emotions are like daily weather. That's nice. I like that. So that's related to the sense that moods pervade and emotions don't necessarily, unless they're very intense. But this whole idea of being pervasive is important. What happens? Okay, well, let me, we're coming to the end of our time. So let me make just a couple of points. I want to say something about the way Rinpoche uses the word experience in that quote that was in the transition, where I said, boy, that's pretty radical. What Rinpoche is saying, he says, experience is the reality known by itself. It's very difficult, I think, to stay consistent about using the term that way, because we just, the whole notion of experience is very fundamental to how we think. It's a historical term. There's a very interesting book, if anybody's really into this, it was written by a man named Martin Jay called Songs of Experience, which is based on the Blake collection of poems. But he's talking about the sense, the idea of experience as a historical development. And it has been argued by Buddhist scholars, some Buddhist scholars, it's a very controversial point, that Buddhism didn't really have a concept of experience in the way that we do. Well, I'm not going to try to sort all that out in 30 seconds. But I do think it's really interesting to think that experience is connected to a self. It's the self that has experience. And since that's so, that means that experience, if you use it in this particular way, is inherently emotional. It's one way, when we experience the world, we inhabit the world. And that has a kind of a power to it. To borrow David's image, it's like being at the base camp of the mountain. You've gotten somewhere, you've climbed at least to the base camp. You've entered into the realm of the real, but you've done it in this distorted way because it's centered on the self. It's the experience of the self. You put experience at the center. And it's so interesting to think about that, because most people who are interested in these things would say, well, direct experience, that's what I'm interested in. And what Rinpoche is saying there, and I think it's connected with this whole idea of emotionality as the kind of dynamic that powers thinking and turns stories into worlds and okay, all that. What Rinpoche is saying is no, direct experience is still putting the self at the center. It's still relying on the knowing and the modes of being of the self. So we would have to have some other word. I don't have another word. Maybe somebody will come up with one. That makes me nervous, because it means that every time you use the word experience, if you use it in Rinpoche's sense, you risk being misunderstood. But in any event, the sense here that the way we engage the world is through experience, and experience binds us to emotionality, and it binds us to a limited way of being where we cannot inhabit the whole. We can inhabit the story, which has been created, basically built up out of the founding story of the self, right? That's how we go through our lives. And it feels better than just being caught in thinking. Okay. I think I have to stop there. Let me look at these these additional quotes. Ken says, story colon, emotionally connected thoughts. Yeah. I think that's good, although I think there's more to be said than that, and I've been trying to say a little more than that. I've been trying to say some of that more, but yes, the emotions, you know, that's kind of what I'm exploring here, is how do you get from a thought to a story? It has to do with the emotions. And then once you've got this emotional mode, which is grounded in experience in this particular way of understanding it, now you have a way of being in the world, for better or worse. You know, it's always going to have limits. Sudhi says, more familiarity with stillness, spaciousness, and stabilizing it allows us to see the gravity, to feel it, and yet not believe its readout or claim. Yes, I think that's right. I think that we're not talking, I mean, Karin asked earlier, what is it like when there aren't thoughts? And, you know, Rinpoche asks in the TSK books, he gives an exercise about the space between thoughts. He asks you to look for the space between thoughts. But if we could be aware of this story-making process arising, and even the you know, the emotion-generating dimension of that, without being caught in it. But, you know, that's difficult because emotions, that's their whole point, really, is to catch us, right? Then, you know, we have the ability or the opportunity to see that happening without being caught up in it. And Hayward said, there is the experience of a separate self that has experience. Okay, so I'd have to think about that a little bit, but I think that's right. Experience of a separate self that has experience. Yeah. It's the difference between the way the self. Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm not going to try to go there. It's just a little complicated, and we are out of time. Okay. Next week, what I want to do is look at, you know, what's an alternative way of doing it, and we will stop there.